Welcome to the Quest Podcast, proudly presented by the Muscular Dystrophy Association as part of the Quest family of content. I'm your host, Mindy Henderson. Together, we are here to bring thoughtful conversation to the neuromuscular disease community and beyond about issues affecting those with neuromuscular disease and other disabilities and those who love them. We are here for you to educate and inform, to demystify, to inspire, and to entertain. We are here shining a light on all that makes you, you. Whether you are one of us, love someone who is, or are on another journey altogether, thanks for joining. Now let's get started. Ladies and gentlemen, today my guest is Brooke Eby. Brooke was diagnosed with ALS in March of 2022 after 4 years of confusing symptoms in her leg. She has almost 70,000 followers on Instagram alone and was recently featured on the Today Show. She hopes to spread awareness of ALS to as many people as possible and, my favorite part, to laugh along the way. Brooke, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to talk to you. And I have to say, you have, you know, as indicated by the intro that I just read for you, you have the most fun personality. And I was watching the Today Show a couple of weeks ago, and I saw your story, and you just have this likable way about you. You kind of can't help but like Brooke.
That's so nice. I hope people agree with you.
I suspect they will by the time we're finished. So I'm going to dive in because there's so much to talk about. Let's start with your diagnostic process. Like I said, it sounds like it took about 4 years for you to get your diagnosis, which is not uncommon with ALS. That can be a tricky condition to diagnose for a variety of reasons. What was that journey like for you to get your diagnosis?
Yeah, you're right. It did take 4 years. So it was a long process. It started with me in 2018. I started limping. I felt like my left foot just felt funny. Like I couldn't push off. Every time I would step, it felt like it was just flopping down. But you know, I've never heard the term foot drop or anything like that. So I basically went to my sister, who's a doctor, and we just did a little living room test. And she was like, yeah, you've got foot drop. You probably pinched a nerve, something, you know, muscular is going on. So I went to the doctor, and that was like step one of 1,000 of getting a diagnosis. I think ALS, it's a rule out diagnosis. So you have to cross off every other potential option. But in addition to that, it's the worst diagnosis you can get. I mean, you're told you have it and you might have 2 to 5 years on average. So I think doctors want to be sure that it's ALS before telling someone, you know, they have this terminal diagnosis. For me, you know, I don't look like what you picture when you hear ALS. I think a lot of people picture their grandparents or a friend's grandparents who might have had it. Typically male, I think, is what people picture because, you know, Stephen Hawking and Lou Gehrig, the faces of this disease are older white men. And so I think for a doctor, it's not, you know, what you picture. When I'm walking into your office, I'm younger, I'm female, I don't have any genetic markers of it. I think everyone was just hoping it was something else. But yeah, after 4 years, it kind of couldn't be anything else. So yeah. I was officially given the diagnosis.
Wow. And I've got to say, you know, I had the privilege of hearing a doctor speak last year. And this doctor is a world-renowned ALS specialist in Houston. His father was actually Lou Gehrig's doctor. And in listening to him speak about this condition, he said, and I don't know if this is a term that he coined about ALS or if it's widely known, but he said that ALS is known to be nice guy's disease.
And have you heard that before?
I have. People comment that sometimes on my social media saying like,
yeah,
like, the best people get ALS.
Yeah.
I'll take it. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure it's a coping mechanism, but hey, I will take it.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to get into, you know, your mindset and your outlook in just a minute, but I had to say that before I forgot to mention it, because, you know, it struck me that he commented that just the nicest people see, and, you know, and maybe that's because the nicest, kindest, most generous, spirited people can handle it. I don't know, but
I am totally in the boat of, I think everything happens for a reason, which yeah. Like, I think a lot of people with any kind of diagnosis might hate when you say that. Like, I think they're probably like, don't say that. I 100% believe it. And I think, I always think like certain people were picked for a reason, like Steve yeah. Gleason picked for a reason. He has changed the whole landscape for benefits for people with ALS. Brian mm-hmm. Wallach, he has changed the entire legislative landscape.
Yeah.
And then for me, it was, you know, a different type of face than people are used to seeing. And mm-hmm. I just said, I'm going to go for it with social media. So I consider more of myself like the awareness side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think all of us were selected for a reason. I doubt everyone else believes that, but in my mind, it's like a very organized system of who's
yeah.
Sick.
Well, and I think it's a healthy way to look at things. I didn't share with you before we started this interview, but I actually live with neuromuscular disease myself. I live with a condition called spinal muscular atrophy. And so I've been in a wheelchair my whole life.
Oh my gosh, and wheelchair girlfriend.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm in mine right now.
Oh, nice. I have a Permobil. How about you? Let's compare models.
Mine's an Easy Light Cruiser.
Oh, okay.
I know. It sounds super cool.
It does sound
cool.
I'm
just loaning it. I borrowed it in January and I've yet to give it back because I can't live without it now.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand. But yeah, I think that there's, you know, and like you said, people's outlook on these things are different. But I think that if you can look at it the way that you just described, or at least, you know, find some purpose mm-hmm. in what's happening to you, I think that that's a healthy path to take. So that's the mindset that I've tried to adopt myself. So, you know, you talked about how you're not what people might picture a lot of the time when they hear about ALS. And I think a lot of people may not even realize that you can get ALS in your 20s or 30s. Is there any difference in diagnosis or in the way the disease progresses based on your age?
Not as far as I know. So in terms of progression, I think that's one of the scariest parts about ALS is we don't know why people progress faster than others. So I'm in a group called Her ALS Story. It's all women diagnosed before they turned 35.
Oh, wow.
And the group grows. I mean, we're at 50 some members now, and we're adding like 2 a month, it seems. And we've seen 4 of our members in the 2 years since the group, 1 year maybe since the group was created, we've had 4 members pass, all in their 30s, some early 30s. And there's no difference between those 4 and then the rest of us. Like, we cannot figure out why certain people progress faster than others.
Mm.
So I don't think there's a difference in how we progress. Like, sometimes I think it's tricky because I'm, you know, so loud about my ALS. And I think people say, oh, well, she's younger. That must be why she's progressing slower. But it's not the case. It's just I happen to be a slow progressor. And therefore, I can use my voice to spread awareness. But the advocacy landscape is so tough with ALS because people die so quickly that we don't have enough time for people to spread their story and spread awareness.
Yeah.
In terms of the diagnosis, I mean, anecdotally, it does seem like we get diagnosed slower. Like, it takes a longer time, but I don't want that to come across as me placing blame on, you know, the medical community, because I do think it's just more rare for a young person to get it. And like I said, no one wants to end a 30-year-old woman's life by giving them that diagnosis. So I think there's different reasons for why it might take longer, but I don't think there's research around how long it takes to get diagnosed. It's just stories that I've
heard. Interesting. So, you know, being as young as you are with your whole life ahead of you, once you received your diagnosis and you had ruled out everything else, I mean, what is it like to be, you know, 30-ish and to get that diagnosis?
It was insane. I wish I documented more of it, but I was in such a state of shock that I couldn't even look at my phone because I knew my friends and family were checking on me and I had no idea what to say. I remember the moment perfectly when I knew it was ALS. I went to probably my sixth or seventh EMG, which is a test where they put needle. You shaking your head, but they stick needles in your muscles and then basically have you flex those muscles to see if it's responding in the right way to your brain saying move your foot. That's not a medical description at all, but for the layman, like, just know that there's needles in your muscles and they can judge like the electricity or something behind it. But I had probably my sixth or seventh one and they stink to begin with, but each one I had had prior to, they had only seen denervation in my left foot. And so this time the guy was doing the test, I figured it was going to be the same thing as the last six. So I was making small talk. We were talking about shows we were watching. Like it was just any other day. And then at the end of the test, he rolled his chair right next to me. And I'm like, this is cozy. And he was like, I don't like what I'm seeing here. I see it in your right foot now too. I think I immediately started crying. Like I remember him having to grab the tissues, although I'm not sure I even knew I was crying at the time. And I texted my sister and her husband, both doctors, being like, it's not looking good. And they were like, what the hell? And then that drive home was just me and my sister and I panicking on the phone. And that started, you know, like a 2 to 3 month period of shock and survival. Like those were the times that I wish I documented because people can see me now and I'm, you know, upbeat, but it took time. Like I was grieving everything I thought my life was going to be. I was picturing myself having a family, my career, you know, continuing. And I just started thinking about those things one by one of like, I guess I'm never going to do that. I don't know how long I have. Like, it's just a really weird concept to wrap your head around. So I think after 2 to 3 months of that, I kind of just stopped trying to think like, how long do I have? Like, it really doesn't help to think in that way. And so my brain adapted, like I learned over time, but I don't want to give anyone the impression that this has been my attitude from the beginning because it was bleak. I ate so many M&Ms. Like I can't even quantify the pounds of M&Ms that I ate. And I think I read a book a day because I was just trying to escape. But yeah, I mean, a year and 3 months later, I can look back at it and like, I just want to give myself a hug, but I'm in such a different place now.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And I have to go, you're so good with words. And you said something a minute ago, I think you should write a book. And you said shock and survival. And that would be the perfect name for your book. I just want to throw that out there in case it hasn't occurred to you. You've got your title.
Yeah, free idea. Thank you.
Yeah. So how did you, I mean, you talked a little bit about, it sounds like, you know, your family and friends maybe were aware of what you were going through and the progression that you were going through with doctors and ruling things out. You mentioned texting your sister and her husband, but once you knew, how did you share it with friends and family?
I hated sharing it.
Yeah.
It's so much. It was like the thing that could take me from feeling stable to just a full breakdown. So in the early, like the first week or two after I heard, after that one doctor's appointment where he said, I don't like what I'm seeing, I immediately told my sister, and my sister is a saint and basically said, do you want me to tell the family? And so we conferenced in my parents and we told them, and then we did the same thing with my brother and his family. And I actually, that was like a moment that makes me giggle in hindsight, because my sister and her husband are doctors. They speak in medical terms when it comes to this stuff. And we were trying to explain it to my brother. And I remember he just cut us off and he was like, English, please. Like he couldn't. And then after that, I like one by one told my closest friends, my closest circle, usually through FaceTime, and I would start crying before I could even get the words out. And they were like, what is happening? Like they knew something bad was happening. Most of my friends had known I had been limping for 4 years. And so it was tough. Like telling someone, it feels like it shouldn't have to fall on the person going through it, because I'm like, I am putting this horrible weight on someone else's shoulders now when I'd rather just shoulder it myself.
Oh,
and it just felt like evil to be like, hey, let me ruin your day for a second.
Oh my gosh.
And so I started telling my closest friends, and then I told the group of friends that I grew up with through text, and their responses went from like funny to hilarious so quickly that I was like, you know what? I think I could make a really funny video about this. And that way I could just share it with people in one fell swoop and not have to do these individual calls.
That's a good idea.
So I was like, I mean, there was a lot motivating me to make a TikTok, but that video, I think, was my first one that really went viral, was me telling my friends over text, because I told them, look, I'm using a cane now. I don't know, you know, if how much longer I'll be able to use the cane, blah, blah. And rather than, you know, any sort of sad responses, my friend wrote back, can I sign your cane? And then one by one, each of my friends was like, I would also like to sign the cane. And then someone sent me a picture of like the Six Flags guy with the cane dancing. And it was just like, It made me tear up, because I was like, man, they are not treating me any differently.
I love it. Not told them.
And so, yeah, that like started my first viral TikTok video. And I think everyone just likes to see that no matter what happens, like your friends are going to rag on you no matter.
Yes.
Well, I'm getting choked up just thinking about it. It was so cute.
It sounds like you have amazing friends that have largely the same kind of personality that you do.
I mean, they're funnier than I am tenfold. And so after that, I started posting the videos to social media, and then I kind of stopped having to have the one-on-one conversations, where now instead people are coming to me already being able to process it on their own and then say what they wanted to tell me, as opposed to, you know, what do you say when your best friend is like, I have this horrible diagnosis? It's like, you almost want to say, I'm going to give you a day, like call me whenever you're ready. So I think the social media piece helped a lot with that, because I was like, go figure out how you want to process this. Know that I'm okay, and we're going to figure this out. I just like want you to be in the know of what's going on with me. So yeah, I don't even remember the question you asked.
No.
Examples. You tell me when to stop.
No, this is perfect. And I'm trying to wrap my brain around how brilliant your solution to sharing this news was, because and I've never heard that strategy before. And it's so smart, because it's hard on both sides. You know, it's hard for, you're already dealing with the diagnosis and the life change and all of that, and having the weight of sharing the news over and over and over. Right. And then, like you said, it's hard news for someone else to hear. So I think that was so smart.
I mean, I think of myself when someone tells me, like, if I have a friend who's like, my grandparent just passed, I'm so bad at responding to that. My instinct is to make a joke or like to try to make light of it and be like, well, like, can't wait till he haunts you, you know, like
That's exactly what I'm going to say the next time a friend tells me news like that.
I feel like I never have. And two of my best friends are therapists. So they have the responses of like, do you want me to offer solutions? Do you want me to listen? Like, they know the right way to respond. I feel like I've never been good at responding.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I'm going to make an outlet for people who are bad at responding like I am, because I think it's a really hard skill.
Yeah. It's so true. That's amazing. So I would be remiss if I didn't also ask you about the wedding that you talked about on the Today Show, because it sounds like that was something of a pivotal moment in your journey and sort of resetting your mindset. Do you want to share that story?
Yeah, it's like a life-defining moment that I was aware of in the moment of like how big it was. So I got diagnosed in March 2022. My best friend from college, I call everyone my best friend. One of my best friends from college was getting married in May, and I was a bridesmaid. I'm like, oh crap, I have 2 months to figure out like how to act normal about this. I was still at the point where if someone asked me about it, I would start crying. Like I wasn't in a stable position.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of my college friends were going to be at this wedding, and I was coming in with a walker, which like how uncool must I have felt? I was so self-conscious, just wobbling my way into the wedding with a walker in a bridesmaid dress.
If anyone can pull it off, well, it's you.
In hindsight, like I look at the pictures, I'm like, I still looked cute. But at the time, like what a nightmare to say, I'm going to go in front of my entire college group with a walker and just like hopefully not have to answer too many questions because I'll start crying. And luckily, like my two best friends in the world were going to that wedding. Really, I mean, all of them were at the wedding, but my two best friends walked in with me at the wedding. And I looked over and I was like, can we just leave? I don't want to do this. I can't do it. Like, let's just go back to the room and hide. And my friend Jackie, who's all over my social media now, was like, what if we just make it fun? Like, or it could be embarrassing, or it could be really, really fun. And we joke because like 3 hours later, we were like, how do we get more attention on us by using this walker? Like, we started having so much fun. We were making people limbo under the walker. The bride was under the walker. I was giving people walker rides. Like, I was the hit of the party. And I was just like, dang, like people don't care about, you know, mobility aids or like,
no,
they probably know I'm going through something just based on my physical appearance alone right now. But like they are just want to have fun and like see their friend. And so after that wedding, I got COVID.
Oh no. But,
yeah, I got a nice little gift from that wedding. But yeah, it was like a really long COVID. It was like 4 weeks of just a really bad flu.
Yeah.
I kind of like, I don't know if I hallucinated or if what happened, but I took a bubble bath to try to break my fever. I opened up the notes app on my phone and I started writing down like things that I have found funny in the prior 2 months since being diagnosed. So when my doctor was like, you should gain weight, you should eat anything you want, my family was like, you're so lucky. And we all started cracking up because we're like, I guess that's not the word we should be using. But it was just like little moments like that where I was finding any kind of reprieve from the depression I'd been in.
Uh-huh.
I wrote down this list and I showed it to Jackie at our next brunch date. And she was like, we're making you a TikTok. Like, we got to figure this out. There is something there.
Wow.
And yeah, it's sort of like, I think the wedding was the spark that flipped my mood a little bit.
Yeah.
And let me say, like, how can I start enjoying this a little bit?
That's amazing. And I think it's also a testament to just the idea that if people love you, they love you, you know?
They do not care.
Yeah, no. But I think for the most part, it sounds like, if not in all the parts, it sounds like the people that were there for you before have been there for you after.
Yeah, I think I've talked to some girls in my support group who have said, you know, they've lost friends because they weren't supportive and they weren't, you know, helpful. I think for me, I'm 34 now. I was 33 when I was diagnosed. I think I had almost like weeded out those sort of superficial friendships prior to that. And my group of friends, for the most part, I've known since I was in kindergarten. Like Jackie and I have known each other since I was four. And then a couple of my college friends are like sisters to me at this point.
Yeah.
And so those are the ones that I care about. Like that is my circle. And beyond that, I was like, if more people want to be added into the circle, great. I haven't seen anyone like pull away by any means.
Yeah.
I will say if you want a dose of humility, your nieces and nephews, if you have young nieces and nephews, they will deliver it to you. Like anytime I'm thinking like, wow, I'm cool. Like I look at my TikTok following, my nieces are like, you're not cool. And like, if you ever need to be brought down to earth, like kids will do it.
It's true. That's so funny because just last night I watched, have you seen Michael J. Fox's documentary Still on Apple to Apple Plus? You should watch it. It's awesome. But he said something to that effect also about his kids. He was like, you know, if you want to be brought back down to earth, he said his kids were like, could you just stop moving for a minute? And so, yeah.
My niece the other day was sitting on my lap in the wheelchair and her legs fell asleep. And when she stood up, she's like, man, it's like I have ALS because her legs were like getting all wobbly. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I mean, they're all under 10, so they don't even understand like this.
Oh, boy.
ALS, and we try to keep that from them for the most
part. Yeah.
But man, they can find humor in anything.
Seriously, that's so good. So
you're gonna have to edit out so many times that I'm saying best friend. It's getting confusing.
I love that you have 87 best friends. Amazing.
They hate it though. Like my two of them text me afterwards and being like, I heard you say best friend a couple times.
I thought I was your best friend.
Yeah, no, it's competitive out there.
Yeah, because seriously. So how do you implement this mindset of, you know, joyfulness and humor, like on a bad day when there are challenges and things, are you always able to find the joy, or are there moments when you just can't do it? Or if you do, if you have figured out how to always find the joy, how, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I have full bad days. I would say I've had bad moments.
Yeah.
So I'll give a couple examples. Like if I fall and I can't get back up, which I can't get back up when I fall. Like that is a 100% hit rate, I guess is what I'm saying. Like if I fall, I'm not getting up.
Right.
Those moments are really bleak. Like those are the moments when I just feel so helpless.
Yeah.
Same thing when I transition into a new mobility aid. So when I went from a cane to a walker and then a walker to a wheelchair, I mean, that all happened in under a year of being diagnosed. I think 9 months.
Yeah,
I was in a wheelchair. Those are the moments when I get upset because it's just a reminder that ALS is always taking. It's not a stagnant disease. It's always taking something from me.
Yeah.
And so those are the moments, I would say, where I get down. But I think I recover pretty quickly. And I think a lot of that is because of the people around me. Like, I've never been able to take anything seriously. I've never been like a deep, heavy person, like poetry. I don't
know. I was going to ask.
No, like, I don't understand poems to this day. Like, deep stuff is like not where my brain goes. That is not where I like to live. Like, I want to live in funny land. And so if I'm having a bad moment, I'll either text a few of my friends, call a few of my friends, or I'll like put on, it used to be Harry Potter. Usually when it's cold out, it's Harry Potter. The rest of the year, it's like a silly show. It's like Kimmy Schmidt or like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is my favorite show of all time.
Ooh.
I'll put that on and just kind of distract myself until it's over. But I don't know. I think your question a lot of people have, which is like, do you film a TikTok video and then go back into like a depressed state? Like, do you turn off the video and then start crying? And the answer is no. Like, I think this is me 95% of the time.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, sometimes ALS will surprise you with something and it'll catch me off guard and that'll get me. But the thing I keep coming back to is like, this is my path. This is my purpose. It would be really easy to get depressed looking at comparing, you know, seeing my friends having babies, seeing them kill it at work. Those are the moments where I think a year ago I would have broken down. Now I'm like, that's amazing for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also doing amazing things just in a different, totally different.
Oh, you so are. Yeah. Absolutely. And I really commend you. I don't know. I may have said this already because it's so true, but I really commend you for using your voice the way that you are and bringing awareness to the topic. And I think also just affecting people along the way and teaching other people how to find their own joy and how to maybe shift their own mindset. And as I was writing questions for this interview and thinking about, you know, what I wanted to talk to you about, I came up with the concept of kind of a joy muscle that you have to, you know, potentially build over time when you are faced with something hard, or either, I mean, life, no matter how you slice it, life is hard for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so we all go through challenges and hard things. Do you feel like, I mean, I know you said that you have always been sort of a joyful person who finds humor in everything. Do you think that there's a joy muscle that if you're not sort of innately, naturally that way, you can train yourself to build?
I love that idea because like with ALS, all of your muscles atrophy.
Yeah.
And so I think the contrast of like building the joy muscle up while the rest of your muscles are depleted. I love that visual. I don't know. I mean, I think if I'm looking at my support groups, it's largely filled with like very grateful people. I think everyone has, I mean, we all have the same brain in a sense where it's going to protect us as much as it can. So for me, that means not thinking about what could have been or the future. Like, I don't go there.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just my brain protecting me. So I think that everyone is more resilient than they think. It's just how they want to approach it. Like, I don't blame anyone for not putting their story out there. Like, that is such a personal choice. I'm very comfortable sharing, obviously. You're probably too comfortable. But I think other people find purpose in other ways. I have friends who are really interested in advocating for research, and they're really detailed in learning more about research. Others who want to focus more on legislation. Like, I think a lot of people with ALS see the challenge that the disease has. I mean, it's so underfunded. There are no survivors. So we don't have these survivor groups to help advocate for us. And so I think we all have a purpose ahead of us, and we just use our different strengths to approach it.
That's a really great perspective, because I was going to ask you, you know, like I said earlier, we all have challenges and hard moments, whether it's ALS or something else. And I think that it's innately hard in something difficult, in challenging times, to maybe find the humor if we're not naturally that way, and to turn something bad into something more positive. And so I think that it's just, it's a hard thing for a lot of people to do anyway. And I love that what you said about, you know, everyone has their own gifts and ways that they may use a situation or look at their situation. But do you have any tips for, you know, anyone who might be going through something hard right now, if they're really struggling to find the positive side, what would you suggest they try?
That's such a hard question. I also, in your last question, I don't know how you're going to have to edit this, but something really interesting happened. So the New Yorker is doing an article about ALS, and the journalist who wrote it interviewed like four of us living with ALS. And I think I was the last one to be interviewed. And I was talking about how lucky I am because I'm a slow progressor. I've got a good family. I'm still working, blah, blah. And he was like, Brooke, you're the fourth out of four patients to call yourself lucky. So like every single person, I think, is finding a silver lining in how they're lucky, which I just thought was incredible. And I was like, man, I hope he uses that somehow in the article.
That gave me goosebumps. Wow.
It's a weird, and maybe that goes back to nice people get ALS. And, you know, I don't know, but I don't think anyone gives themselves enough credit. Like when people come to me and they say, I could never approach this the way that you do. I'm like, how do you know? Like, give yourself some credit because I didn't think I would, like, I knew I liked being goofy, but I didn't think I was going to approach a terminal illness with goofiness. Mm-hmm. Like, no one expects it. For advice, I mean, I think for me, the best thing to fall back on is purpose. Like, I think if you get into the mode of comparison or into the mode of people are going to judge me, like anything that sort of comes with the stigma of having a disease, or maybe it's, you know, not a disease, but it's something else that you're going through. I think everything has a purpose. And that's what keeps me going. Like, I know that my whole life was training for, you know, the years that I'm going to be able to advocate for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm able to like map those moments of training to what I'm doing now. And I'm like, wow, I really believe this was all meant to be. But beyond that, like put on a good show, eat some Thin Mints. Those are my coping mechanisms. Is I eat like a box of Thin Mints a night. Like I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. I can't stop. It's like truly an addiction. But yeah, I mean, I think give yourself credit is like my first instinct because I don't think anyone trusts themselves as much as they should.
Yeah. That's true. The word control popped into my head too while you were talking. And I think it's, I mean, I'm not a psychologist. I just play one on podcast. but, you know, I think too, if you can let go of what you can't control, like, are other people going to judge me? You can't control that. They are or they aren't. And I think it can be important to just to recognize what is in your span of control and to let go of everything else. Easier said than done, I'm sure.
Really?
But yeah.
I totally agree. But I think I don't even have to actively do that. Mm. I think for me, like my brain does that for me. And nice. I talk about my brain like it's an entirely different species inside of me. But like the things I can't control, how fast I'm going to progress, what I'm going to look like in 5 years. Am I going to lose my voice? Like those things I don't even think about. It doesn't cross my mind. And so I think like that's hard to explain to someone who's not going through something serious. But like you said, letting go in a sense of like, you don't have to actively say, I can't control that.
Yeah.
I think you just have to let go a little bit and trust that your brain will do it for you.
That's true. That's a great point.
It's so hard to explain. It's like so vague and meta, but hopefully
I think, you know, just the nature of what you just said, just let happen what's going to happen, at least in part. And I think you expressed it beautifully. I know that you are also a big proponent of ALS research and looking for treatments and things. What goals do you have in all of this? What do you hope will come of your public sharing of your journey?
Yeah, it's gotten more specific over time. So when I started, the thought was just awareness. That was the one word. But, you know, a few months into that, I was like, I don't really know what that means. Because now I have this platform and this following of people who say, like, utilize us, like deploy us. We are resources.
Oh, wow.
So I really had to start thinking like, what do I want from people? What can actually move the needle here? And so I keep coming back to this one conversation I had with there's an executive at Salesforce who's a huge ALS advocate, and he has been a guardian angel to me since I've been diagnosed. But one of the first conversations we had, he said, it's a money problem. Like, he's like, I looked at it from a business lens. It is a money problem. It's an underfunded disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that translated as like, okay, how can my community on social media help address this? So I started making call to action, which I think are really hard to come up with
as an advocate.
But as of lately, it's been one, call your congressperson, because there is a medication that's going to have an advisory committee in September called Neurone that has a lot of promise for early stage ALS patients. So call your congressperson and ask for that to be accelerated. I made that ask, and a week later, the ad com was scheduled. I have no idea if it's related, but I fully give TikTok some credit.
I think it's suspicious
for moving the
needle.
And then the second, I've been doing fundraisers on my Instagram for research organizations, for labs. Mm-hmm. And so I'm asking people to donate on my Instagram and to share it with their friends. I think the more people are Googling ALS, like if we can get a little uptick in that, I'll consider it a success. And then lately, I've been thinking, how do we go bigger and how do we open up new revenue streams? So I'm starting to target like high net worth individuals and celebrities with my videos. I haven't put one out yet, but I put out a video saying like, tag the celebrity that you want me to do a 1 minute pitch to.
I love that.
So one of the, like, people are writing like Elon Musk or Taylor Swift or like the Kardashians. And so for each of those, I'm trying to think of a creative way to get their attention. So for Taylor Swift, my niece, who's 10, has an incredible singing voice.
Oh.
And so I'm going to rewrite a Taylor song and about ALS and have her sing it and see.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait.
I think it's like a cute, people want to feel part of something. And so I think for people to come and see that video and then be able to tag Taylor Swift, it's like, I helped a little bit. And so little things like that. I mean, at this point, it's like me just going rogue and hoping, you know, something sticks to the wall. But yeah, those I would say are really the things I'm asking of people right now. And that's my goal is like ALS, we're going to get a cure, whether that's in 100 years or 2 years is directly correlated to money.
Yeah.
The faster we can get money into these research labs, I think it'll just do speed to the next result, whether that's a breakthrough on the science side that I'm not even going to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Then that'll get to a breakthrough on the patient side. Like, speed to impact is my number one goal.
That's amazing. And you're so right. I mean, research is expensive. I've learned a lot more about, you know, the science and research that goes into developing these drugs over the last few years. And it takes, I mean, billions.
It's like $2 billion a drug, I think, on average.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
and the drugs that we have today, I'm able to take three of the drugs available today because they're not the genetic type of drugs. They are expected to slow down progress by like a few months. Like they are not exciting drugs. I mean, it's exciting when anything happens for ALS, but
sure,
impact is not super exciting.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're, you know, benefiting from what we have available today. And I think that clearly people like you and the circle that you run in, I think that you're going to do amazing things for the progress of this condition. I'm so proud to know you and happy to have been able to have this conversation with you. Final thoughts, you know, as we bring it home, what advice would you give to somebody out there who may be listening, who may have just received their ALS diagnosis or have a loved one who was just diagnosed? What would you say to them?
The first thing I tell people always is to find a support group. Because that saved me at the beginning. Like, you don't know where to start. I mean, whether it's an ALS diagnosis or maybe like an anxiety diagnosis. Like it mm-hmm. could be anything. I think finding a community of people going through the same thing is such a moment to exhale, because you're like, I finally can ask the questions that I didn't know who to ask to. Like, and I can look around and see people who might look like me going through this. So you don't feel like such an outsider living mm-hmm. in the world. So find support and find a support group is number one. And I think two is that there's a role for everyone. Like, let yourself grieve for as long as you need. Mine was 3 months, but I'm a freak. And I think it probably should be like a year.
Yeah.
If we're looking on averages, but take the time you need to grieve and then use it as a purpose. Again, not just ALS related. It could be for anything, like yeah. SMA or whatever yeah. you're diagnosed with. I think if you're interested in social media, like I am, there's a role for you there. If you're interested in legislation and going to the Hill and advocating mm-hmm. there's people to help you do that. Like there is a role for everyone. Or maybe, you know, you don't want to leave the house because you're uncomfortable. There's things you can do there too. Like I have friends who write blogs about ALS because they're like, we're not comfortable talking in front of people. So we prefer writing. I also have people who sit around and call their Congress people every day. Like, depending on what your strengths are, mm-hmm. use them to your advantage and turn it into a purpose, because otherwise it's really easy to slide into like, why me? But I think it should be more like it's me for a reason.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I can't think of a better note to end on. That was so well said. And I just can't thank you enough for sharing your time and your story and for, you know, being vulnerable and showing us all how to laugh. And again, just thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It did kind of feel like therapy. I got to say, you are a good armchair psychology.
Well, maybe I will, you know, make my title official then.
Yeah. Yeah, you should.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the guests you heard from today, go check them out at mda.org/podcast. And to learn more about the Muscular Dystrophy Association, the services we provide, how you can get involved, and to subscribe to Quest Magazine or to Quest Newsletter, please go to mda.org/Quest. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be grateful if you'd leave a review. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so we can keep bringing you great content, and maybe share it with a friend or two. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, go be the light we all need in this world.